I'm very pleased to welcome back to Fremantle Shipping News, Catherine Allen. Welcome back, Catherine.
Thank you so much for having me again.
It was virtually, almost exactly, just about 12 months ago.
It was.
Where we sat and talked about your manuscript that had just won the Fogarty Literary Award and everything that came with it. And you told me then that the book was going to be called The Skeleton House and you'd be working on it, getting it edited, and it would be coming out in 2024. Well, here we are. I'm holding The Skeleton House. Isn't it fantastic?
It is beautiful. I am over the moon with what Fremantle Press have done with it.
It's just beautiful. It's got, what colour do you call this back colour?
It's almost a navy.
Almost a navy.
Almost a navy blue, but a little more blue. And then the fuchsia font really pops, and the hummingbird is just stunning. That's the funny thing about, you write this book, and you go through the editing, and I know the words inside and out. But then it goes off to some extremely talented artist. It was Nada Bakovic, I believe. I'm completely butchering her surname. Bakovic. Nada, they gave her some sort of, brief, and away she went and designed this cover, and it's nothing that I would have imagined. You know, it's a completely different imagination, and I'm stunned.
Well, I'm hoping that you will get an appropriate size of the front cover and frame it, because it's a work of art, isn't it?
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah, get a poster size.
A poster size would be perfect. And it gets a lovely wrap from Annie Hartnett, the author of Unlikely Animals, and Rabbit Cake, who says your book is a gorgeous, relatable novel, keenly observed and beautifully written. I adored it. And I suspect a lot of people are going to. We talked about the plot line to some extent a year ago.
Yes.
And I'm going to encourage people to go back and listen to that podcast, because you refreshingly told us about yourself, about how you came to want to be a writer, how you became a writer, how you did an MA at London University. And this, in every way, came out of that.
It did.
Although I do remember you telling me it was in the middle of COVID, and at one point, in a sense, not knowing what to do with yourself, you rewrote some huge chunk of it.
I did. The world was sort of felt like it was ending, and I decided to break my book. That was my way of dealing with the kind of mass anxiety we were all dealing with, is, I deleted half the book and wrote it back up again, and it turned out to be the right choice. So,
well, our listeners who don't know you will have detected you seem to have a North American accent.
A little bit.
We can confirm that. And it sort of hinted at, if you just read the blurb, if you like, that comes describing what the book might be all about, what the novel is. Tumbleweeds, roadrunners, no stoplights. Welcome to St. Stephen's, Nevada. The desert town Meg has been trying to escape since her teens. As Meg's husband, Kyle, builds the perfect home for his young family, Meg finds herself facing a future she never wanted, with dreams that aren't her own. Resistance comes in increments, joining a Mormon book club, coaching her high school debate team, telling bedtime stories about the past to her son. But what happens when your ticket out has become the key that locks the door? Whoa, we have to read this.
A funny little behind the scenes for you and the listeners is that blurb on the back jacket was drafted and written via email with my editor, George Richter, while I was hurtling on a coach down to Albany with about 30 year six girls on a school trip that I had volunteered to supervise. So that's the behind the scenes. Us authors all have other, day jobs we're doing. And I remember we were trying to tease out the exact wording of the jacket blurb, and that's what it was done. It was over email.
Well, I can just imagine you're sitting on the coach, you've got your phone, it goes beep, and you look down and it says George. Well, you know you have to answer.
Well, absolutely.
You can delete the others, but George is.
Yeah,
you
I need to pause singing Taylor Swift with the girls.
Wow.
And need to.
Well, we'll talk about Taylor Swift on another occasion, but let's talk more about your book. Just, I'm fascinated, and we sort of touched on this a year ago.
Yeah.
With the feeling that you have, the sense that you have, whether it's relief, whether it's excitement, when the book suddenly appears, you've done all the editing, it's out, you can't go and change anything, the cover's agreed, you've agreed with George what it says on the back of the book, and here it is. How do you feel?
Well, it was really wonderful that I got my first author copy in my hands just a few days before Christmas. So they told me, it's in, you can come pick it up. I drove down to the office and Georgia had wrapped it beautifully, little eco-friendly book bag that she makes out of fabric with a little ribbon tied around it. Opened it up and it was very surreal. You know, it's this beautiful jacket. They'd done all the packaging, but then I sort of flipped it open at random and went, oh, those are my words. You know, it is this really interesting feeling as an author to, you know, have this beautiful, they've done the packaging of it and made the beautiful jacket. But when you open it up, it's like, no, those are my words that I've worked on for so many years over and over and over again. And it's still, yeah, I get a buzz every time I sort of flip open the book.
The setting of a book has always fascinated me as well. I've just opened it at random to pages 132 and 133, where you've got little breaks between paragraphs with a little line. I don't know what they call that in the publishing world. Then you've got the paragraphs, then you've got what are, in a sense, little headings within the text. Mm-hmm. And it takes on an art form again of its own, which in a sense isn't yours, because someone's had to set the type.
It's so true, because I'm used to seeing the manuscript on sort of A4, you know, Word document, and was used to sort of seeing paragraphs and lines laid out in a certain way, and then it's been typeset, and that's all been kind of rejigged around, you know. So yeah, you're very right.
And here it is. Well, it's going to hit the world big time soon.
Very soon.
I remember asking you 12 months ago, how do you think the people of Nevada will receive the book? Have you given that any further thought?
Oh, I mean, I don't know. I've sort of tried not to think about it too much, because once the book's out in the world, I have no control over it. And reading is such a subjective experience. You know, there'll be people who will love it. There'll be people who are intrigued by it. There'll be people who dislike it. And that's absolutely fine, because if we all like the same thing, I think the world of literature would be very boring.
Well, you've set it in a town which you've called St. Stephen's, and in the acknowledgements to the book that you've written, it says the town of St. Stephen's and all characters are fictional.
Yes.
And any resemblance to real people is entirely coincidental. Mm-hmm. Then you go on to say, which fascinates me, however, the overall vibe was inspired by real regional towns in the American Southwest, particularly those found in the Mormon Corridor. There are occasions where the beliefs expressed by the characters in this book do not align with LDS Church, which I'm taking for our readers to mean Latter-day Saints Church doctrine. Faith is complex, and churches are built and run by humans. Yes, that's true, isn't it? Tell us, so people understand that, the Mormon Corridor runs from where to where?
It's sort of a region that encompasses a lot of Utah, a bit of Arizona, and it was where the Mormon, the young kind of Mormons settling, coming over, ended up kind of settling down there. So there's quite a significant Latter-day Saint Mormon population that is in that region of the Southwest of the United States.
Yes.
And even up to Utah, up to Idaho as well. There's quite a few towns.
And as I've read out, Meg, you're the major protagonist here, joins a Mormon book club.
Yes, she does.
What would be distinctive, because I'm not a Mormon and not a member of any book club, actually, love books, but what would be distinctive about a Mormon book club?
When I say Mormon book club, it just happens that Meg is the only not Mormon woman in the book club. So it's not an official, you know, church book club. But like growing up in a small Mormon town, many of the community events and groups and, you know, gatherings were sort of in some way facilitated by church community groups. So my brother, for example, was part of a Boy Scout troop that was run by the Mormon church. And we weren't Mormon, my family, but, you know, he was very welcome. It was, you know, nothing that you had to be Mormon to attend. But it's similarly a group of, in this book, a group of women from the local Mormon church decided to create a book club, and Meg's been invited along to it.
Well, there's going to be some lovely twists and turns, and that's already intriguing me. I love when I learn something new. When I was a teenager, I would have been about 14, in the regional town of Western Australia. There were some people nearby who had just come. A fellow was a mining engineer. His wife was a young, clever woman, and they had all of Ian Fleming's Bond novels. And I sat down and read them. I'd never heard about Shark Fin Soup, let alone a lot of other stuff I read in the book. There's so much to learn in a book.
Oh, so much.
So do you think to an Australian reader that they're going to learn things as they go along in your book, starting out in Nevada?
I hope so. I hope I've portrayed the region accurately and with, you know, some colour and depth.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now, I have to ask you about this. You acknowledge all the wonderful people who helped you along
yes.
the way, but the very first one goes like this. There are several writing mentors who helped me on my journey.
Mm-hmm.
Colon. Mr. Tussler, is it?
Tussler, yes.
Is the OG wit.
Yes.
I've got no idea what that is. And his forensics with an uppercase F manifesto included infamous rule number 7. Quote, be friends, not lovers, close quote. And there's a bit of a hint here, I think. Megan Neely, N-E-E-L-E-Y, did not comply. So tell us about Mr. Tussler.
Oh, Mr. Tussler, where do I even start? So I was sort of gently and lovingly bullied into joining the forensics team, speech and debate, by my friend Braden. And you know, in small towns, you sort of have multiple connections with people.
Yes.
So Braden was one of the first people I met. His brother was in the same Boy Scout troop as my brother. We were, you know, we did swim team together, and he said, "You're very, very clever." You know, I went by Katie back then, so he goes, "Katie, you should join, you know, speech and debate." And I went, "I'm homeschooled. I'm terrified of public speaking. I don't want to join the debate team." And my parents sort of said, "Braden's got a good point. This would be a very good opportunity for you, a learning experience."
Well, it's worked, Catherine.
It has. So, despite my misgivings, I did join the team. And famously, the first speech I had to give in front of the class, I ran out of the room crying. I was just petrified. I was 14 years old. I trouble raising my hand in class. But yeah, I got over my fear and went on later to be captain of the debate team my senior year of high school. But Mr. Tussler, he was English teacher, and he'd been teaching so long, I think he could have taught my mother in kindergarten. He'd unsuccessfully retired several times and kept coming back to work. You know, just, I think he was addicted to it. Lovely, lovely, wonderful, dry sense of humor, taught English, and he taught the debate team. But one thing he did that was very clever is he structured the debate team so it was sort of this self-perpetuating organism. So the older, more experienced members of the team, because American high schools are 4 years, it's years 9, 10, 11, 12. So sort of the seniors, he called them the veterans, would kind of coach and mentor the younger new students coming into the team. And in that way, he could, you know, kick back, give some guidance, let us research and prep to our own devices, and he would sometimes mark some papers while we were, you know, busy whittling away, looking at current events. He had this forensics manifesto that had a series of rules on it. And infamous rule number 7 was be friends, not lovers. He had no time for teenage drama and, you know, breakups and that nonsense. So that was his way of saying no.
Now, my literary education is obviously going to be boosted here. So the OG is the, what?
It stands for original gangster. It's a bit of just silly slang I threw in just as a bit of a laugh. But Wit is the debate coach in this book. He's the original Wit. So Wit is gently modeled off of
him. Nice to know that these people. And there's another reference here that in your acknowledgements that really had me thinking.
Yeah.
And you thanked, amongst others, the delightful cast of characters at the Old Vic Theatre.
Yes.
This is in London.
It is.
Where I wrote a good portion of this novel, you say.
I did.
Tell us about that.
Well, my husband, Michael Burrows, is originally from here in Perth.
To whom the book's dedicated.
Yes, it is, yep. So we met on the master's program. That's what brought us together. And we had about 7.5 amazing years in London together, did the program, and he worked at the Old Vic Theatre. So he was the Old Vic has a wonderful cafe, and it's open during the day. So they shut down during actual show times, but any member of the public can walk in and have lunch there and have a coffee and sit in.
Take their laptop, sit there and write a novel.
Absolutely. So if I, was off work a little bit early or he was working a bit late. Oftentimes I just pop up at the theater, get a coffee, sit down and work on my manuscript. And very, very inspiring to be in that space because the whole building just exudes artistic energy and creativity. It's a producing theater, so they put on so many new shows, and all of Michael's, you know, colleagues were artists in some right. So they were directors or they were actors or, you know, they had other things going on. So it was just such a wonderful creative space to work.
The creative juices must have been flowing in a place like that.
Absolutely.
And I imagine there's photographs of the odd famous actors on the wall too.
Yep.
Let's come back to the skeleton house.
Yeah.
I remember saying to you, do you reckon the name will survive? I'm always fascinated about how books are titled. You told me it would because it really did really come to it. What are the things you want your slightly more perspicacious reader to take from your book?
Oh, what would I want a reader to take from the book? Well, to enjoy it, certainly. It's a book that, I mean, books are meant to be enjoyed. I wrote the book that I wanted to read. Whenever I write anything, it's because I want to read it. And I can't quite find it. I mean, I write for a number of reasons, but that's at the heart of it, is I'm a reader first, and I write books that I want to read that are fulfilling. I'm very interested in relationships. I think that's something that's a theme in everything I write, is teasing out these relationships, a lot of times family or within a community.
Here we've got Meg and Kyle to start with.
Yes. Yeah, and their marriage, and then with the children. Meant to be enjoyed. I wanted to write about, it's a difficult topic, but write about the topic of coercive control and emotional abuse. It's often very invisible, and it's a tricky topic to kind of tackle. And
the Dixie Chicks, as I used to be, the Chicks, last album, is called Gaslighting.
Yeah.
It's an insidious process.
It is. And it's something that is really tricky to tackle in art. And I thought the novel was sort of the best form to do that in, because you have enough space and time to have those sort of subtle, manipulation that is going on and having it escalate and creep over the period of time over the novel.
I suppose we can't promise anything to the readers, but they're not going to be left totally distraught, I hope.
No. That was another thing, is I'm really drawn to books that tackle difficult themes but still have warmth and light and humor, because I think at the end of the day, even in the darkest times, whether they're real or fictional, we all have to have something that gives us a little bit of hope and meaning and something that's worth fighting for.
Yeah.
And that was something that was important when I wrote this book, is that Meg is in a very tricky situation, but she's not this hopeless damsel in distress that's waiting, you know, for someone to come save her. She has to be clever and figure out how to deal with this predicament she's in. But she does have help. You know, she has two wonderful, bright, bubbly children that she takes a lot of refuge in. She has the Mormon Book Club, which, it's funny you mentioned that earlier. Very early in the book, Kyle kind of ushers her towards that Mormon Book Club. She really wants to start taking some university classes and kind of re-engage and look toward getting a degree. And he says, oh, no, you don't need that. So he ushers her toward the Mormon Book Club, thinking it's going to be this nice, safe, submissive space for her. And, well, I don't know if you've not been part of many book clubs. I've never been to a submissive, quiet book club. The women in it are very energetic. And
I was going to say, they're usually populated by women, so it's,
yeah.
It's an oxymoron to suggest they're submissive. The book opens with, in fact, a quote from the Book of Mormon, beware lest there shall arise contentions among you. Then you have I'm not sure what it's called in literary writing terms, which you've got what's not a chapter, called the helicopter.
What do
we call that?
You know, I'm forgetting the exact term for it. I'm sure there's something clever that Georgia would, my editor would call it. But it is, there are three short one-page helicopter passages, for lack of a better term, that They're not actual chapters, but it's just a page, or it's a little snapshot, a scene.
It's interesting. I've read about and so fascinated about this before, whether you set something up, some sort of portent to what's going to follow, or summary of what's just happened. I think it's really interesting. But then there's chapter one, and I'd love you to just to read the first paragraph.
Yeah, absolutely. Chapter one. Sand crept into my sneakers. Half a mile away, it looked like it was made of toothpicks. A little closer, chopsticks. Then lumber. The framing of our new house, erected by the polygamists who call themselves Mormons. Our Mormons call them a cult.
Now, that is just a great opening paragraph.
Thank you.
If it's not the opening paragraph of the book, because we've got the helicopter page before
yes.
it. But boy, draws you in straight away. So the Mormons call the Mormons. Yes.
Yes. So it happened. Now, this is where my history and dates, I won't be able to give you the encyclopedic definition, but quite a while ago, kind of early settlement before Utah became a state, there were Mormons who practiced polygamy. And then there was a branching off of the more modern day Mormons, the Latter-day Saints. And then there are still kind of the fundamentalist Mormons who do still practice polygamy. And we do see them around town sometimes. So when I go home, sometimes they'll be shopping at the Walmart that's sort of 40 miles down the road. And there the girls and women are all dressed in kind of little house on the prairie dresses, very traditional hair. And yeah, they are around.
Wonderful place, the United States. Fascinating.
Oh, it is. There's so many pockets with these very interesting kind of subcultures that unless you're kind of in the region for a time, you wouldn't know existed.
Beware lest there shall arise contentions among you.
Oh, it was too good. Considering that the book talks about, you know, contentions within the domestic sphere, it was just too good of a quote.
Did you find some things out about yourself, about how you thought, about how you approached life, relationships, as you wrote the book, as you finished it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the first draft of this book was written around 2016. That's quite a while
ago. It's a long time ago.
It is, yeah. And I wrote the first draft over 2016, 2017, and then sort of kept coming back and doing edits before, of course, it was picked up by Fremantle Press. But yeah, over the course of several years, you know, a lot happens in life as mm-hmm. well as, you know, in the book world. I feel that in order to really write about a space or a moment, I need some time and distance from it. Mm. So I don't think I could have written this book if I hadn't gone to London, funny enough. I think if I was still in that community, I wouldn't have written this book because I would be kind of too distracted by all the details of the space while I'm in it. I need a bit of time to step away and have it distill and really remember the most important.
I imagine you need perspective as well.
Yes.
When you're
yes.
caught up in perhaps the eye of the storm, you don't quite appreciate what's happening around you as much.
Yeah, and a lot of aspects about the community that I grew up in, being this very small town, conservative town, but the nearest city is Las Vegas, the complete opposite. And some of the things that, you know, were very normal in my upbringing, I didn't realize how strange they were until I got out and started talking to other people. And, you know, you go, oh, no, you didn't have children walking pigs on leashes down your street, just taking their pig out for a walk? And people went, no. I'm like, okay, that was fairly normal for me, but.
This is going to cause a tourist boom in Nevada once people started reading it.
Yeah, yeah.
Guided tours of West Australians. All your old friends and Marvelous. Everyone will be heading
they
off.
They need to show up during the county fair. That's when you'll get the big taste of it.
Now, leaving the Skeleton House for the moment, I suspect your writing career hasn't suddenly come to an end. When we last met, you were well into working on your next work. How's it going?
It's going really well. I've had to put it on pause at the moment with all the launch activities and
yes.
interviews ramping up, very exciting. But I will hopefully start querying that very soon. The next draft, the in the next draft, the second book, I'm kind of working through the final draft before I begin sending it out and trying to get that published. So,
well, very exciting. That's exciting. And I suppose you could always pick up a character like Meg and take her into the next phase of her life. But I wonder what it would be like to write those novels where you have a character who keeps on going on.
Yeah, I've thought about that. I've had a few people ask with the second book if it's a sequel or a continuation. Mm. And I mean, I do feel a little bit of it's kind of a bittersweet feeling because I have absolutely loved sitting with Meg as a character.
Yes.
She has been such a big part of my life, and I just love her as a character. So it's a little bit hard, seeing the book in its final form and knowing that I can't go back and tinker, But I feel like that chapter, that book is done, and I don't at the moment have any interest in renewing her story. I think I'm going to leave her to her own devices. I think she's going to be fine.
That sounds good for me. So what can you tell us about what you're working on?
Well, the working title is Quiver, second book, and it follows a homeschool family that have 11 children.
Just a mere 11. Do they have a pig with a leash on it?
They don't have a pig with a leash on it, but they have a couple of chickens, a couple goats, and a alpaca that was a freebie.
Well, that's going to be interesting.
It is.
Is it going to be set somewhere far from here?
It's United States again, so I've set it up more in the Pacific Northwest, Oregon. That's where I was born and went to university, so I do have strong ties with that place as well. It's set up there, and it sort of follows the path of the four oldest children as they age out of the family home and they're sort of finding themselves. Mm. They've grown up in a very, very religious, kind of insular family unit.
I mean, just segueing ever so slightly, but coming back to something I said earlier, United States is a fascinating country. The politics are such that we're about to enter into the latest phase of the next presidential elections.
Oh, yes.
Two old men, older than me, Joe Biden, the current president, and Donald Trump, the former president. And Australians sometimes think they understand the US, but I think there's an awful lot they don't understand.
And speaking as an American, sometimes I think I understand the United States, and then I realize I don't either.
Yes.
It's a very, very complicated, large country with so many aspects to it.
And I suspect what the skeleton house and then the quiver are probably going to show is that there's a lot of regionalism in the United States.
Absolutely.
And there's such localism, and it has its own background and its own reasons for existence. So if you talk about politics, it's not even nuanced, it's highly visible, the differences.
It is, and I feel that in a lot of popular culture, because I know that over here you get a lot of American television shows and in movies, but it's a lot of it is focused, on the coasts. You get stories in New York, you get politics in D.C., you get, L.A. cops in, Southern California.
And that's America.
But it'd be like if you tried to say that Sydney is Australia.
Yeah, ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. There's so many other aspects to the country. It's so diverse. And the regionalism, I think, are the true kind of hearts of a country. Those are the little beating hearts all over the continent that really show you the map of a place.
So your book, I think, and probably the new one from what you're saying, have this sort of, is it a macro quality? I mean, you're looking at things in the big span, or are you really coming down into the nitty-gritty of people and what makes them tick?
I'm going to say both. I'm going to cheat a little bit because I think that often you will find the universal in the micro. So if you really zoom in on one specific town and one specific family and one story, there are universal themes that come out of that. And that is something that I'm very passionate about, is when I read a story, I really want to get into the characters. I want to understand them. I want to see what makes them tick. I want those interactions they have with other characters where so much is said, but so much is also unsaid, and really sort of teasing out those details. And that's something I did here, really focusing on that family and those interactions. And I think it has some wider universal themes that will appeal to many readers.
Well, I'm sure like me, they can't wait to read them and find them. Good luck with the launch and everything that follows. Enjoy your life as you go on the media round.
Yes, yes.
Talking about it. Very
exciting. This is my first one for the publication, so thank you so much for having me.
It's been a pleasure, and this is going to be great fun. Look forward to it. Thanks, Catherine.
You.